think we get going. Thank you very much again for being here. This is the 9th Mesa Seder. Sounds like almost too long we've been doing these, actually. It was a really wonderful session to kick the seminar off. We started debating pensions, the welfare state, and democracy. Professor Ken Minogue is known to most of you as a former president of the Montpellier Society, the International Society of Classical Legal Scholars. It was founded by Friedrich von Hayek in 1947. He's emeritus professor at the London School of Economics. He belongs to a very distinguished group of thinkers that you can still call with your proper definition. It used to be, for most of the history of mankind, philosophers. They're no longer mankind. You've got scholars of philosophy, people studying history of philosophy, but very few philosophers. Ken is a philosopher indeed. Has his longtime associate and friend in the way mentor Michael Hawkshaw. I was born in New Zealand. He is Australian, it may say so. He is really a British citizen. He wrote a very beautiful book in 1963, The Liberal Mind, was translated also by our friends at Liberi last year into Italian. His last book is called The Servile Mind, and was recently translated by Ibiele Livis from Leone's Publishing House. They're very happy. We need to translate the Servile Mind. You may remember that Tocqueville described democratic despotism as a kind of mild, apparently peaceful, regulated servitude. Professor Minogue's book brings you into an analysis of democracy that goes beyond the standard public choice, political economy, libertarian critique of democracy, most of you will be very well acquainted with, and brings also its libertarian readers into a more deep, sociological in a way, but actually, it's not sociological, because that sounds demeaning, really, sociological these days. Two analyses of how democracy changes deep down the dynamic of social thinking. And that's a wonderful book. If you didn't read it, please let me recommend it to you, particularly if you're an Italian, if you read Italian, so you can buy the book from the end of the English edition. The theme of this Mises seminar is failure, why we did it. Of course, I mean, it doesn't sound a particularly optimistic subject. These are not good times for optimists, at least if you read the press. But we're tackling the subject of failure from a variety of different point of views, from economics, from the welfare state, banking system, movements. Tomorrow, all of this is going to be this Mises seminar. Professor Minogue is going to be giving it as a philosophical view somehow, and this talk is very beautifully, but somehow, how can I say, obscurely entitled Failure, Freedom, and Enterprise, FFE. I'm very, very pleased to give Professor Minogue the floor. Please join me in welcoming him to the
Thank you very much. It's an enormous pleasure and privilege to be here, and I'm delighted to participate in what is quite an interesting theme. I mean, I've been sitting here for 2 days, and the word failure has been coming up like a motif in a Wagnerian opera. And that reveals, I think, the interesting point that failure is a conceptual discovery procedure. We look at the world and we say this and that failed. The moment we say it failed, we then can begin to try and identify a cause of it. And if we can identify the cause, we can sometimes, well, occasionally, prevent the failure from happening once more. Interestingly enough, these two things hover on the edge of moral judgments as well as explanatory judgments, because having found a cause for failure, we often say, who do we blame? Do we blame the government or the people? And blame, of course, sets up a moral attitude to things. So failure is extremely ambiguous and ambivalent. Anyway, that's one or two initial remarks. I shall not, I think, be profound as a philosopher ought to be, but I shall be wide-ranging, I think. In other words, I shall not only be analyzing failure in a way, but also illustrating it. And in saying that, I am, as is conventional in using this concept, taking out some social and rhetorical insurance against your possibly judging that I have failed to do whatever I ought to have done. There's something almost paradoxical about succeeding in describing failure. Now, in modern life, individualists succeed and fail, and they do so because they are individualists. For in the modern world, most individuals have enterprises of their own, commercial, romantic, hunting, intellectual, familial, and all the rest of the things we get up to. And this gives them a passionate stake in the outcome of whatever they are trying to do. Sometimes they attain what they want, and sometimes, of course, they do this thing called fail. Life is a succession of events of this kind, of successes and failures, for most of us, that is to say. These are the twins, success and failure, of the practical world in which we live. We have, of course, a passionate desire to succeed, and the result is a vast literature of books teaching the reader how to manage his or her life so as to be successful and how to avoid failure, or at least how to come to terms with it. Is this, in fact, the universal human condition? I don't think it is. It belongs to our modern world because most human beings have always lived their lives in traditional societies. In a traditional society, there is a hierarchy of different social statuses, and people live with the rule, with the duties, and up to a point with the rights of each status. So they're not really involved in this thing that I'm calling enterprise. But enterprise becomes much more common in European societies, which I think invented this whole scheme of life, around the end of the Middle Ages, when people began drifting to towns, leaving behind the agricultural solidities of past social relations and moved to cities. And that's when individualism emerged and people began pursuing whatever enterprises they wanted to pursue. And that meant, of course, sometimes they succeeded and sometimes they failed. In traditional societies, I think you don't have the same pressure to succeed or fail. I'm intrigued by the Indian village that was reported in the newspapers recently as having abolished love. Now, what was meant by this was that in this particular Hindu village, they'd decided that lovers should not be able to get together of their own free will. All marriages had to be arranged. And that's what they meant by abolishing love. And of course, if there is an arranged marriage, how it goes is really no concern of the managers, and besides which, since there's no divorce alternative as a rule, the whole question of success or failure doesn't really come up. So it seems to me that in this traditional world, we don't have the same sense of failure and of success that we have as individualists in the modern world. So failure is not, I think, a universal condition. It is, I think, something which is vibrant in the lives of two sets of people: individualists, as I've said, and secondly, children. Children are great exponents of enterprise. To be a child cannot be anything else but an exploration of the world in order to find out how to get what one wants. Does one cajole? Does one burst into tears? Does one hold mummy's or daddy's hand? It's all exploration of what gets you what you want. And hence, children, I think, develop whole modes of conducting themselves which eventually settle in to the kind of thing we call character. The second set of people, as I've said, are individualists who spend their lives, as we all do, hoping to succeed. We, of course, by and large, like children, we eventually settle into routines and procedures that work for us. And in that sense, we keep the actual riskiness of enterprise to some extent at a distance. So success and failure are central to our modern experience. And in exploring it, we must be aware of the many dimensions of failure, and I shall be discussing a number of these various dimensions in a brief kind of way. One dimension is, in fact, the sociology of enterprise, and in exploring this, we must be aware of what it involves. As I've said, children and individualists are involved. That's sort of the sociology. But another dimension is the logic of success and failure. I'll come back to that in a moment. Success and failure has a structure of understanding, and its relations with, say, providential interpretations of the world are interesting. I mean, one of the ways in which people in traditional societies often understand the things that happen to them is in accordance with the will of God or providence or possibly fate or luck or something of that sort. Success and failure only become prominent when it's our fault or it's our triumph that is the key to these things. Again, political science is a major arena in which success and failure are important, and I shall presently make some remarks about the greatest of all theorists of this subject, who is, of course, Machiavelli. One may indeed well go into into our culture in exploring the dimensions of this, and above all, I think, in the theological aspect of success and failure. Our religion is, in one sense, the relation between the divine and human in terms of success and failure. Thus, God created, according to the Christian story, a perfect world, which was then destroyed when men and women ate of the tree of knowledge. And this created the sinful world in which we live. There's a sense in which God failed to create the world we imagine he might have wanted. That raises, of course, all sorts of bizarre problems about omnipotence and omniscience of God. But the interesting thing is that particularly in more recent times, the fall of man is seen in terms of what I think it was Milton called it, the paradox of the fortunate fall. Had human beings not fallen from grace in that particular way, they would not be moral creatures, because they would not be creatures who respond to the right thing and the wrong thing to do. So there's a certain triumph involved in the failure of the fall of man. And the same thing, of course, goes with the career of Jesus. A divine figure who is crucified is certainly not instantly a case of success. But it turns out that this particular failure is one of the great triumphs of the divine world. In fact, this develops all sorts of religious ideas later on. That is, there's always a tendency for new people to come along and say, well, it failed with Adam, and it failed with Jesus, who was crucified. The third prophetic appearance in the world will be successful. And I think that's explicitly the doctrine of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, the founder of the Moonies. And of course, there are large numbers of others. In fact, the theology of failure in Christian terms is extremely interesting indeed. And I think what it does mean is that in our civilization, failure is recognized as having an importance and indeed as having a paradoxical character. The meek shall inherit the earth. I mean, you know, those early bad people tried to build the Tower of Babel so they could look God in the eye, as it were. But at least out of that, they have got the great variety of literatures and languages of which the world is currently composed. Is there a logic of failure? Well, within the general sphere of power and skill words, failure appears as a condition contrary to success. Success and failure are specific versions of the operation of power in the world. Success is notionally the consequence of power and skill, and that is why many teachers these days believe that their task is not to teach people the stuff called knowledge, but to teach them things called skills, because a skill is a power to make something happen which we want to happen. So educationists constantly talk about skills. On the other hand, a skill is merely a matter of technique. And when we try to achieve things in the world, especially in relation to other people, there are two aspects to it. One of them is power and technique, but the other, of course, is dealing with other people in order to get the response, or something like the response, that we want to get. Trying is, of course, a product of will and true judgment. The consequences happen in the world, and other things than merely failure or success are almost certain to result. These are the things which you will be familiar with as unintended consequences. And nearly all actions do have unintended consequences of one kind or another. The philosophy of Michael Oakeshott is in part a matter of contrasting technical knowledge with practical knowledge, and understanding the great corruption of rationalism as being the belief that all knowledge is technical. In other words, if you have the right skill, you can always produce the desired result. Indeed, this is, in another version, this is the great illusion of power, which is that if you have enough power, you can command things to be the way in which you want them to be. And therefore, power and command are the opposite of failure. You can, and this is the reason, of course, why politicians are very keen on power, because the more power they have, the more they will be able to solve whatever they construe as problems. I mean I'm tempted to digress onto the European Union, where of course the euro problem is one which incompetent politicians set up in their pursuit of the steady progression towards a single realm in Europe. It has proved a notable failure, whereupon these curious incompetents say, but if you give us the power to control the fiscal situation and to discipline the economies of all of these national states, then it will be all right. Indeed, it will be a great advance. And it's a marvelous direct example of that principle in politics. Of course, in politics, there is the problem of moral considerations. Machiavelli, I think, is the great theorist of failure and, of course, of success. And you will remember that he rested success upon the thing called virtù, not quite virtue, indeed, in some cases, not at all virtue, because you may have to lie and deceive and conceal what you're doing, and on the other hand, fortuna. And he thought, you may remember thinking about Caesar Borgia, that success came from virtue and fortuna, but fortuna was just a little bit more important than virtue, and I think he was probably right. I suppose, in a sense, why God invented poker was to teach everybody that there is no alternative to playing the poker hand you've got, because there is no other way in which you can carry on. And that is a recognition of luck, which I suppose socialists want to abolish if they possibly can. I also had some reflections upon success and failure in the historical perspective. Success and failure can be exhibited not only by individuals, but of course by cultures and by civilizations. The rise of empires is often the discovery of some cultural or military device that proves to be immensely successful and leads to the domination of one particular culture at a certain moment. For example, knights in armor dominated the early Middle Ages, but then they were overturned by the longbow, which could knock knights off armor very easily, and of course very soon firearms and cannons and things of that sort. Changing circumstances make it important, and of course there is a constant interaction between the dominant technology, military technology and all other sorts of technology, and the response to it. As Walter Matthau remarked cynically in a film some time ago, when they build a better mousetrap, what they forget is that the mice get smarter too. Doesn't always do the mice much good, but and it's in this arena that one of the basic facts of success of the success-failure relationship must always be remembered. Success is the seedbed of failure. Because humans tend to standardize whatever succeeds and to become trapped as characters in these standardizations. Thus, the historian J.H. Eliot observed that after three or four centuries, the Spaniards became convinced at the end of the Reconquista that the way you got rich and prosperous was by warfare, by taking it. And when they moved to South America and controlled South America, they set up elaborate controls, and they used their power to take over a great deal of wealth. I know about this because there is in Australia a Chilean sociologist called Claudio Veliz, a friend of mine, who wrote a book on the Spanish experience in South America and the English experience in North America. The English experience in North America was simply to shovel this riffraff who were being a pain in the neck in England, they were Protestants of an excessive kind, off to America and more or less leave them alone until they began to want to tax them in the 18th century rather more than was familiar. That was a success of a certain kind. The Spaniards, on the other hand, tried to set up in South America a replica of Castile. Indeed, to some extent, according to Veliz, trying to control the people who were allowed to emigrate to South America. And this has produced a less dynamic result, I think. I think that the success of European civilization, and the success of European civilization is one of the great themes that constantly provokes me to think one thing and another, depends very importantly upon failures. One of the absolutely central failures was that Europe never turned into a single empire. They looked back to the Romans and they yearned to have a single empire, but they never managed it, fortunately. The Habsburgs, in a way, tried it, and the Bourbons tried it, and then, of course, Napoleon and the Kaiser and Hitler, and there was a lot of trouble, but nobody succeeded, at least until the EU, and it doesn't look as if that is in a very healthy condition. That meant, of course, that Europe developed local areas, you know, Italy and as you can see from Italy, the great city-states that pioneered the individualism of the Renaissance. France, again, didn't become the France we know until the 19th century, because until that time, a lot of the French recruits couldn't even speak French. They were Provençal, or they spoke some form of patois. And the Dutch and the Swedes and the Poles and all the various dimensions of Europe, whose interaction has been an enormous power in the world. So that's one interesting failure. I think that the failure of any single confessional form is also significant. Innocent III was a very dominant figure, of course, in the Middle Ages, controlled a great deal of the life of Europe, but he ran into quite a lot of problems, and so did his successors when they ended up in Avignon. And of course, then you have the Protestant development of Protestantism. And again, you get plurality. I think the point about nearly all of this is that traditional societies think that success in a way of living is agreeing on everything. And therefore, the key to Sharia or to the Hindu caste system or to Confucian China or to tribal worlds is that there is a single agreed understanding of the world, which doesn't really come naturally to people, because human individuals are extremely ambivalent in their responses to the world, and we are peculiarly ambivalent. And what distinguishes Europe, I think, and one of the things that has made it extremely successful, is that we can live with ambivalence, and we do so by civility, by the rule of law, by a certain respect for rules, and so on. I've jumped around a certain amount because I promised Alberto that I would stop after about 30 minutes. The last time, or one of the last times I was speaking in public, they warned me that if I went on too long, the ice cream would melt. At least I don't have a melting ice cream problem here. But what I do have is quite a lot of other developments that I might have gone into, but perhaps we will come to them during discussion. I was going to end by referring to an English poem by Rudyard Kipling called If. The English have a category called a good bad poem. A good bad poem is a poem that has no literary merit, but has a terrific swing. And If is a kind of moralistic poem by Rudyard Kipling, and it's famous, and I can simply quote the two lines, because they are inscribed over the Wimbledon tennis courts. It says, if you can meet both triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same. And it goes on. And this is, I think, a sort of gaming response to the success and failure and that understanding of our lives. Failure comes in part from the Latin fallere, which carries with it the sense of, carries with it the sense of deceit and deception. And that interesting etymological point, I think, is important because it suggests that what we think is a failure may often not be a failure. I mean, that's the point of a great deal of the religious traditions which dominate our civilization. So deceit and deception are involved. Even in cases, you remember the La Fontaine fable about the fox who went after the grapes, and he failed to get the grapes, and he went away muttering to himself, they were probably sour anyway. Well, they might have been. The point about this really is that to succeed and to fail is to respond to one aspect of one's life under certain circumstances. And in the contingent world we live, every life has a whole variety of aspects. And failure is focusing on one of them. And you can turn it upside down, and what looks like a failure in some terms can turn out to be a success, either in the long run or from another point of view. Well, these few reflections on success and failure might perhaps illustrate Alberto's thesis that we need failure, but there is no doubt that in the business schools and sometimes in the hiring of people in corporations, there is a strong tendency to prefer people who've got a failure behind them because it is the beginning of wisdom.